Hey, Dan.
Mr. Rob, how are you doing today?
I am awesome. How are you?
Good. How's the world of solutions, engineering, and development?
Busy.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. We live in this digital world, but we also live in this physical world, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit later today, because we have a esteemed guest, Peter Dixon, who is the chief. Well, what is your current title, Peter? I always see it changing a few days. Every couple of days on LinkedIn, it switches.
It has been chief creative officer for probably the last 5 years.
Okay, good. Maybe it's everyone else over there that seems to be putting a few extra like symbols between their C and their O. Great to see you here on Zoom. I know we have listeners, so great to hear you. You know, you've had a pretty awesome career. You're one of the people I love to talk to and just riff on. I still remember an awesome car ride with you in Baltimore where we were just kind of, you know, going off on all things, kind of brand, customer experience, et cetera. But you've done a lot of things. So I'll let you give your like 30 second to 60 second kind of who you are and kind of the course you've taken through and how you've landed at one of the kind of the top global brand customer experience firms out there.
Sure. I started my professional life as an engineer, a mechanical engineer. And what was really good about that was kind of an introduction to systemic problem solving that has served me well for, you know, the duration. And it also opened up my eyes to a bigger world. I was doing offshore construction of all things. And, I was in Asia and the Middle East and India and found that the cultural aspects of the world I lived in far exceeded the code driven engineering solutions I was responsible for. And, on a time off, I spent some days in Paris and, accidentally fell into art as a complete novice in the topic, and art and the world became much more present in my thinking, and that kind of sent me on a direction toward architecture. And I got a degree in architecture here in Texas. I'm back in Austin now, and that actually set me on a path of doing a different kind of creative work. And I moved to New York and I worked with some big architecture firms there and learned the craft, and then accidentally got a job in a branding firm. I didn't know what branding was. I didn't know what brand was. It was a firm called Zinsmeyer & Lux, who were the preeminent corporate identity firms of the 80s and 90s in Europe. BMW, Deutsche Telekom, Lufthansa, ABB, all those big German brands were clients that I was fortunate enough to work on. And I learned a lot from that team, and Jörg Zinsmeyer particularly was an inspiration in terms of understanding the power of brand. And he actually taught me something that I came to value about brand and still do to this day. And he talked about it, that brand was, in this kind of Swiss German way, that brand is the realization of values, right? He didn't talk about logos, he didn't talk about graphic design, though he was the designer of the Swiss currency. Have you ever seen how beautiful that currency was? He designed that pixel by pixel in a vault in Zurich.
Wow.
But this actually idea of realization of values became a real modus operandi for me in terms of doing branding. And the realization of values for me became more and more not about what you say, but the experiences you create as a company. So I know the architecture background kind of played into that. And I grew up doing retail design in branding firms and doing retail concepts, which kind of, it led to me do big rebrands of Walmart and Delta Airlines and McDonald's, all through the lens of value realization and building brand relevance. So anyway, it's been a great journey to profit, where I was designer number one, walking in the door there as a designer to a bunch of marketing and management consultants. And, I've been there now 12 years, and, now we're operating globally. We compete with all the big brand guys, but now we're competing more with the RGAs and Razorfishes and Digitases of the world, as well as McKinsey, Bain, Deloitte. So it's been a great run. I moved to Austin to be adjacent to our digital team here, because I believe that that the next generation of experiences will be digital and physical, and you know, have some great, you know, we've got a great team down here. We're starting to build those.
So. Awesome. So, hey, we want the 411 on profit, but I want to go back real quick just on your personal history. I knew you were an architect. I had no idea you started off as an engineer, which is pretty awesome. Was there a picture or a statue or an exhibit or like, what was it, man? Like, take me to that moment.
Yes. That moment, that was in Paris. And, you know, I had gone there, you know, on time off, you know, of course there was a woman involved in chasing them. And when I got there, they had a French boyfriend. So I was completely at loose ends. I really had, you know, I was like, wow, okay. So here I am. And I went to, and you know, in those days, the Impressionist collection and museum was the Jeu des Pommes, which was a small little building, you know, near the Tuileries. And I went in there not knowing what was what. And I stood in front of a wall of paintings of ballerinas by Degas, right? And it was amazing. Just, it captivated me in some, I'm sure, you know, broken heart, romantic way too. I don't know why. It was dark and, you know, and strongly feminine. And somehow it kind of captivated me. And that night I was having drinks with friends of my then ex-girlfriend. and they told me, well, what did you do today? And, you know, I was so new to this idea. I said, well, I just saw some paintings today by somebody named Degas. And like, cause I'd never heard, I didn't know how to pronounce it. I didn't know anything about it, but it was an essential experience of this feeling in the presence of something that, you know, was a little sublime and transcendent. And it taught me about that kind of essential experience. And from then on, I, you know, that's what kind of got me to study architecture and, you know, sit in a dark room with slides and learning about art history. I think a little bit later in life was like the best experience of my life, you know, that just absorbing the arc of culture and its expression in the world was, you know, it was all very foundational.
And Peter, how old were you? Like, when did that happen?
I was 24, 25 years old, I think.
That's awesome. What a story. That's brilliant. And so then, you know, you mentioned, so now we fast forward kind of through your career and then you kind of end up, so I did two stints at Profit, you know, so I kind of came into Profit around 2000, still kind of growing. Scott Galloway had founded it, kind of brought in David Ocker, and then Michael Dunn, the current CEO, just kind of came on board. And it was very kind of like brand positioning stuff, like David Ocker's books, one, like just follow the David Ocker book. Right. And then I think, you know, I had left and kind of went through this transitioning and kind of like, you know, probably took on more of the analytical world. And then I remember I said, oh, there's this guy named Peter Dixon, who's going to be the chief creative officer. And I'm like, oh man, poor guy. That's going to be an interesting ride. Right. Right. And it was an interesting ride, but a very, you know, a very great one. But like, so, and I think you like, what I love about you is I think you understand that connection between kind of like the business and the analytics, you know, kind of the ROI of branding, and then, you know, branding as a kind of visual expression, a verbal expression and experience. Can you give us a little bit of a history, maybe not a history lesson, but almost like kind of like Peter Dixon, PhD kind of professor on how we got to where we were and how it became more sophisticated? Like, how did those two things actually come together?
Well, I told you the story about, you know, my orientation around brand was always about values, you know, as an expression of value. So it kind of transcended the marketing, you know, sell something kind of idea. We knew at the end of the day, you were building preference, you're building frequency, and you're building loyalty, right? Those are the dimensions of that, you know, why we have jobs in branding. But I think that was the orientation I was lucky to have started, not in an agency, to think about brand as part of, you know, brand does not equal campaign. And, you know, the idea that in doing brand through a retail lens, you know, the experience was the brand, not what we said it was, not what color we was, not all those things mattered, but it was the experience was the brand. So I was able to bring that story to the team at Profit, you know, and to this day, they talk about you know, I walked in there and talked about strategy-led design. And that hooked them right away, you know, because I wasn't coming in there to say, we're going to start making pretty things, which I think we do now. I think we make amazingly beautiful things. But I think that the intention is about the activation of strategic ideas to drive market behavior. So that has not changed, and that continues to be how we shape this. And now our toolkit, though, has really expanded. It includes UX, includes campaign development, includes you know, visual, verbal, motion. You know, so there's a lot of things that we do now that have enriched our ability to create emotions, that create the behaviors that make our clients successful.
Awesome. Now, give us the 411 on profit real quick for those who are not familiar.
Profit's the last of the big independent branding agencies. We're about 500 people. We're in 12 offices around the world. We're really a really great interdisciplinary group that works from a kind of a management consulting base through expression and brand activation and marketing, innovation, digital, and experience design. So we're kind of a fully capable shop to go from ideas to activation and create market impact.
And Rob, I'll open up for some questions on your side too. But one thing I will say, like when you engage with Profit, and especially a Profit designer, it is the ability, and I think this is where you and the rest of the Profit team have done a great job of getting the strategic thinking designers right. And I think that is really kind of been that's the key part, right? They're not, you know, you walking into a design meeting with Profit designers is intimidating as a strategist, because you better be ready, because they're going to bring the strategy.
I like the idea that we have strategic creatives and creative strategists.
Yeah.
And it's been that blend, I think, that has been, you know, you think about some of the senior strategy people, they may not tout their creativity, but when you see the inventiveness of business model, business design, you see the ingenuity of customer insight leveraging, right? They're super creative. They're really a creative group. And, you know, it's like we've never had a process. You know, we're very creative in how we do the work as much as the outcomes are. And I think that all speaks to, we've all found I like to call it common cause. I mean, it's an ethos, a shared ethos, but I like the way that we make common cause across the board with our different disciplines and areas of expertise.
Awesome. Rob, are you following any of this? Are you tracking, or are you just still trying to figure out what we're talking about?
I'm trying to figure out how to spell loyalty. I think I got it. I Googled it. No, this is actually an interesting turnabout, because, you know, Peter, in many cases, we have a podcast topic that's technical, and Dan plays a great foil to unpack these ideas. And I feel now that the shoe's on the other foot, and I'd love to.
Well, thank you for using foil, not dumbass. I appreciate that.
Did you hear the pause? It was my head.
I did.
It was in my head.
I knew it was intentional. So that
it was the theatric pause. I could be a stand-up comedian one day. So we talked about, you talked about preference, frequency, and loyalty. And let me give you a very simple example, and I'd like you to explain to me why it worked on me. The old Walmart font sucked. The new Walmart font feels fresh. Why is that?
Because Peter Dixon designed it, right, Peter?
My team, I was at a different firm at the time, but I had a great team on that.
Hold on a second. You did it? I was asking that just as a genuine query. That was not a softball.
I led the team that did that.
Okay. Well, congratulations.
Well, look, there's a lot, you know, and this is back in like 2005, you know, mid 2000s. And you know, they were at a tipping point of having the permission to operate in certain parts of the country, right? Reputationally challenged, and you know, the idea of the big box, you know, crushing mom and pop, you know, it was like this a big thing that was limiting to the business. So this brand refresh to them was not an aesthetic exercise. You know, it was super intentional. And, you know, the best conversation I ever had with a CEO was with Lee Scott, who was the CEO of Walmart at the time. And he was talking about why he was excited about brand work. And he said, like, I know it's going to drive some good advertising, but what I'm really excited about is it becomes a blueprint for my people to know what to do. I thought, now there's the smartest CEO I have ever had a conversation with. And apologies to all the great CEOs and smart CEOs I know. But it goes to
what you're speaking. It's an expression of values. And if people really know their values, then you don't have to look at a book. You just like behave with the values.
That's right. And I think that Walmart was, you know, highly misunderstood as a corporate. A lot of good people there, a lot of good intention about, I mean, and the new tagline expressed that, help save money so they could live better. And that was the big shift, right? To really shift to this idea of not about just driving margin by beating up vendors. It was really about helping people save money so that they could live better. For example, the idea of the apocryphal story that I heard in the course of this thing was the mom who said, you know, it used to be every school year I could only buy one of my kids a new outfit. But when Walmart came to town, I could buy both kids new clothes to go to school. And that really resonated with me as an idea of this enablement of a little bit better living. You know, that was something that they could really contribute to big. But, you know, they took that and, you know, introduced a natural organic food at scale that changed the food industry. They actually changed the food industry by bringing that to their stores, their pharmacies going into places highly underserved, you know, medical and pharmaceutical deserts where they become the only supplier of pharmaceuticals and now healthcare. And all the good things they did with energy efficiency and all these things where they found that combination of saving money and doing things better, right? Like the skylighting in their stores. And if you ever walk down the aisle of their frozen food area where in quiet times, those lights and those things are dark, but motion sensors turn on the lights when people are in the aisle. Those kind of small things added up to a big shift in that company. And the visual expression came last. The visual expression was the last thing we did. We freshened up the stores. We cut some of the clutter in the store. We modernized it just to catch up with the people's expectations about retail, even value retail. But the font and that spark, the spark of the logo, this is the spark of smart shopping, you know, because you can be smart about how you spend your money. And that font was trying to be friendlier, really moving from a slightly militaristic, bombastic kind of expression of a brand. And they weren't really that. It was a complete misalignment who these people were down in Bentonville. And the idea that they could be a friendly, you know, more neighborly. And so the soft edges, the upper lowercase, getting rid of the hyphen, all the elements of that new identity really were an expression of values and intention for the company they wanted to be.
Are those design characteristics like mixed case and soft edges, is there science behind that? That say if people do sort of the ink blob test on this topography, they're going to feel friendliness?
Yeah. Yeah. There are real studies about shape and color that really do create, in my, you know, the science I've seen is that people remember shapes and colors. I think identities are built around shapes and colors, not names. And so the shape and the color and those combinations of such actually is what imprint on us and that we recall. And there's a lot of science around sharp edges, soft colors, right colors. Each color means something. Every color means something to us over there culturally. Now, I'm more familiar with Western culture. And is there some variations of these things that are very culturally driven? Uses of yellows and whites and things have different meanings in different cultures. But there's some essential human condition elements like of the color blue. You know, color blue is such the popular color in all the world. Is that because the sky is blue for everywhere? Is that because oceans are blue sometimes? You know, I don't know. But yeah, there is some science behind it and testable. And, you know, we have done a lot of that kind of testing. And it's usually not surprising because it does line up around these kind of heuristics we have around soft edges being friendlier, softer colors being more accessible, brighter colors being more energetic, sharp edges being more, kind of aggressive. So yeah, we have some thinking behind that.
Awesome. One more. How many more questions do I get, Dan?
You're already over by five.
But okay. Okay. So let's turn this around. Like if you're being intentional about a design, connect design decisions. Let's say. Let me ask a question. Did you participated at all in the Apple Store?
No.
Okay. So let's take that one. Let's as sort of a use case. Why the tables? Like, what are they trying to make me feel, and how does that connect? Because I love the whole, like, you know, the brand is values, but I'm so ignorant about the connections. All I know is I walk in there, I'm like, this feels like an Apple Store. Of course this is an Apple Store. I could have told you from 5 miles away before I even saw the logo. Why is that? Like, what are the, call out just two or three things, like, whatever. Sure.
Well, like, the tables are a great example. And, you know, I have heard this, you know, the inception Apple story told multiple times by different people who take credit for it. Right. So, but I think that if you just took it as a retail person, right, what you see is an expression of their overall design philosophy, which is reduction. Right. If you talk to Johnny Ives and his, you know, and he participated in this, he's completely about reducing things to their most essential elements and making them work well, and then infusing them with quality, like, I mean, quality material, quality of tactile and sense of feel. So that, and it comes from Jobs too. He had this idea that, you know, I bet if you look under those tables, they're just as beautiful as the tops too, right? That this is really important. And so when that tabletop is a essential way of how a standing person can interact with the product at their kind of lower to waist level and have these things displayed in a way that allows you to see choice described on the table itself and create accessibility. And even more important, the ability to stand next to someone for the demonstration as across a desk. The ergonomics of it, the simplicity of it, the thoughtfulness of all the elements is just endemic of their overall, you think, their hardware, software design aesthetics brought to a retail environment.
So I'm sitting here being surprised and yet ashamed at myself for being surprised that there was that much thoughtfulness into a table.
Well, and right. I think there's two things I love about this. One is your wonderful daughter giving us some amazing soundtracks in the podcast. So thank you for bringing her to this. And then secondly, it's around, you know, because the question I had, Rob, I think you asked really, really well in a kind of a layman's kind of way was, how is brand strategy, you know, kind of, how do you take that which used to drive kind of, you know, visual, like really, we think like in a visual marketing way, translated into customer experience design. And Peter, I think you just explained it, right? Because you said that like Apple's brand is all about, you know, the essentialism, right? Kind of removing the clutter, et cetera. And then that example is just really speaks to that.
By the way, Peter, do you know who Sergeant Slaughter is?
Oh my God.
Any, just off the top of your head, Sergeant Slaughter.
Comic book, character.
Close enough. We'll wrap up with that later, Dan.
Well, just you mentioning Ives, that's why you saw me throw my hands up on the video. It was a long running issue with Rob and I. So he thinks he's the reincarnation of him with his audio sophistication,
no.
Which ends up having, you know, we've had issues. I'll leave it at that. We'll move on.
Just saying. I knew Dan would get defensive. Sorry about that, Peter. So
Rob, I'm gonna ask another kind of take us in a little bit of a different direction. But if you have more thoughts, go ahead.
No, take us in a different direction.
So, Peter, I think the world of brand and marketing for decades, if not a century, lived on this idea of differentiation, right? And I think, you know, I think that in the brand world, and probably in the within the halls of profit and similar firms, you know, that's starting, like, that's moved on a little bit. And I want to have you talk about why and how. But I do think actually the concept of differentiation as you get into the halls of companies, right, and businesses still lives large. Everyone wants to know why we're different, right? Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about how that thinking has shifted and how you and Profit have really kind of thought about it in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, brand in terms of being different has been a little bit in different terms of recognition. You know, like you recognize one brand versus another, you know, one, you know, something versus something else. And I think there's always will be a role of distinction that I think is a part of brand. But to chase the false god of relevance, I mean, of differentiation, flies in the face of what motivates people. You know, you can be different in a way that doesn't mean anything to people, doesn't deliver any value to them. And if you're different for that, it's kind of a fool's errand. We believe that relevance trumps differentiation every day. That you, you know, standing for something that matters in people's lives is the thing that will drive preference, you know, preference and loyalty. And we think that that is the sense that we don't want to take our eye off the ball of what matters in the service of what's different.
I hear the word relevance and I automatically conjure a definition and what I think it is, but how do you define relevance? What is brand relevance?
Well, relevance is just the word. I mean, relevance means that it matters to what's at hand, right? And if we're talking about people's lives, their purchase behaviors, their families, their lifestyles, their, you know, it's just the definition of the word relevance. We've kind of dimensionalized relevance, you know, for commercial purposes. You know, we publish something called the Brand Relevance Index every year and have done for the last 6 years. We've actually, you know, tried to dimensionalize it in ways that can be measured. And, you know, it kind of, we believe we use 16 attributes in the study. There's four kind of big areas around customer obsession, pragmatism, inspiration, and there's one other dimension that's come to mind right now. But I mean, these dimensions are real. You know, how much does a company actually, you know, care about me? Do they make me happy? Do they inspire me to do things, to deliver things in different ways? Are they innovative? Oh, innovation was the fourth element. You know, how innovative are they? Do they continue to make things better for me? Right? Surprise and delight. So yeah. So this was the top 10 brands for this year. And you know, obviously this is an anomaly. You know, this was done in the fall of 2020. So this is the top 10 brands for this year. Apple has been in the top spot for the entire time we've done the study, but the rest of these players in the top 10 are new this year.
Interesting. So we're an audio podcast. We don't do visual. So just for those, go to profit.com/relevant-brands-2021. You'll see Apple, Peloton, KitchenAid, Mayo Clinic, Lego, Costco, Honda, Johns Hopkins, PlayStation, Amazon. Those are the top 10 in that order. And, you know, talk to me a little bit about, like, clearly kind of Mayo Clinic and Johns Hopkins, you feel like a direct result of COVID. Is that what you found?
Yeah, no, they become more sources of truth in the time when, you know, kind of our institutional, you know, players like the CDC were less trustworthy. And so people were moving to the healthcare providers as sources of truth. Johns Hopkins, obviously, you know, were the source of statistic and data across the pandemic. You know, this is a good list. I mean, you see some things like Amazon playing such a big role in people's lives during this period. So kind of obvious, Costco as well, but some surprise, even Peloton, right? You know, they were just kind of breaking into our top 10 or 20 a couple of years ago. And now they, you know, they really took their spot during this pandemic when they became such an important player across many of those dimensions of customer obsession, innovation, pragmatism, and inspiration, right? And what I love about this study is not the obvious things. To me, it's the surprises, like KitchenAid, right? A KitchenAid being number three most relevant. Well, it's not me, but I tell you what, every year they're up high because their products play a role in people's lives, right? And they have great design and they have great content that surrounds this. They continue to innovate. So they've been a great kind of unexpected, you know, most relevant brand for years. But again, this year, a lot of the cooking at home also kind of, I think, jump-started their ranking.
And I love, you know, I love Lego kind of being on there. I think is Lego, is that historically been this high, or was this new for COVID as well?
It's their highest position I think they've had yet. They've been in the top 50 for a while, because they really do play a role in people's lives, and, you know, innovative and inspirational and really, you know, do a lot for people. Now in the design of the study, you can look at it online, you know, you have to have considered or purchased the brand to be in the study. Right. And it was 13,500 participants And each participant reviewed five brands, and it could be across any category, anything. So, yeah, this is the only study like this that doesn't really, it's not about stock price. It's not about, you know, financial. It's really about what consumers think purely. And it really gives us a nice snapshot to how people are feeling about companies and their importance in their lives today.
Awesome. Rob, I'm going to switch topics again. You have anything, questions around relevance?
I do. I have, what words would you use to describe the loyalty that a company like USAA exhibits? Because a checking account's a checking account. They actually don't have the best rates, but you know what? You would have to, you're going to get me to switch as I die. So why are they not on this list? What are the words you would use to describe their power? What's their superpower?
Well, I think definitely affinity, right? They are the ultimate affinity brand and have found a group of people with shared values that they are that they wear on their sleeve, and they're able to monetize that affinity through great loyalty and they deliver it with great customer service too. They're like one of the best customer service.
So where does that and that's where I was going. I'm glad I accidentally led you to that. And Dan and I spend our day lives talking about customer experience, particularly in support mechanisms. And sometimes they're bad. Like if I don't remember you and you call in and I say, tell me who you are, as opposed to, I notice you're calling in, you know, from a number we know, Peter, how can I help you? Just that, wildly different.
Absolutely.
So where does that factor into consumers' grades?
Across the board. I mean, it's something that we don't ask that specific thing. We ask about products, experiences, and services that delight me. That's one dimension of the 16, but we don't go deep on that aspect. But I always love to see that many of the brands in our top 50 are really experiential brands, right? And they've made their living creating great experiences. I think that it's a, again, I believe that brands are definitely built through experiences, and that this next generation of experiences will start to exhibit those things that you started to touch on there, Rob. I believe the next generation of experiences will recognize you. Recognition will become an important, powerful element of this. And maybe it's your phone number, your name, or your face, but also this may be your state of mind because of the context you're in. It'll recognize your context. And then it will be able to personalize, right? Respond to you in a personalized way. The next generation experiences have to have that. They will have that, right? And along that, there will be rewards that will come to you that will mean something to you, and you'll be rewarded in a certain way. And then respect. And I think respect takes on new dimensions. It used to be respect, respect my data. Now it's going to be respect my health. Respect my health as well. Respect that. Better respect that pit bull over there too. But I think recognition and response, personalized response, and respect and reward are those new dimensions that the next generation of great experiences will exhibit and will win with. They will win with.
I love it. I love it. Taking notes.
And one thing on that too, Peter. I love the fact that we used to live in a world where if you walked into a hotel room and there was a note from someone and maybe like a bar or a beverage or something. It didn't matter what it was. You're like, oh my God, that's amazing. But now not now, but as we kind of go back into hotel rooms, I remember I went in one of the last times I traveled, and there was a printed note that was not handwritten. And then there was a can of beer waiting for me from a local brewery, which, printed note, I'm like, come on, seriously? And then beer, I'm like, well, if you knew who I was, I don't drink beer, right? And so, the expectations on experience are just on this hockey stick upward thing. But if you're not designing those in and figuring that out, you're going to be left to the dustbin of history.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that, this pandemic has also jumpstarted expectation around, new ways of fulfillment, new ways of connecting. And I hope, and as horrible as this was, I hope we can learn the lessons that make a better future and, you know, allow us to tap into learnings around behaviors and expectations that will drive better solutioning. You know, so I'm optimistic right now. I mean, I got my second shot 2 weeks ago, so I'm ready to go. but I'm also also cognizant that, you know, this has been a very bifurcated disaster. It's, you know, easy for me and you know to kind of cruise through this, and but I think there's a lot of people out there. This is not easy, so I don't want to make light of the that there are benefits to this.
Yep.
But I hopefully there'll be improvements as we go forward that everybody can share in. And hopefully what we've learned will be distributed in a way that changes everybody's life a bit for the better.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of related to that, I think brings us to the last topic, which is digital physical, right? And I think there's, you know, back in the day, there was this false dichotomy between, you know, digital and physical. There's a digital and then there's a physical, as if we kind of like lived two different worlds, two different lives. And so unless you played a lot of Second Life, you know, that wasn't necessarily true. Did I completely date myself with Second Life? So talk to me a little bit about, you know, and I think COVID, as you said, is, you know, accelerated things, but also then changed how we are going to think about any expectations that consumers have for experiences. How is this kind of digital physical experience design going to come out of COVID over the next few years?
Yeah, it was coming out. It was on its way. You know, I mean, there's a lot of great experiments, particularly in Asia, around this that is at scale that are making changes. You know, the COVID experience, I think, though, was a pause for us to think about, you know, the physical kind of ways that humans transact and you know, this notion of shared spaces, like what's going to be different about our shared spaces. And I know there's a pent-up demand and there's going to be a lot of people in shared spaces really quickly here. But I think what's going to change is that we'll be thinking more intentionally about the use of the space. And I mean, from retail stores to workplaces, you know, office design, transportation, healthcare, I think the place will become not the default area of delivery. It will become a more purposeful aspect of the interactions, connections with consumers, customers, visitors, students. And so I think that is something that's really going to be the big change, that this intentionality and hybridization of things to happen. Like, for example, there'll probably be a really push on touchless elements of interaction for a while. I'm not sure how long that will last. Maybe it's a permanent fix. But there's definitely going to be the expectations of anytime, anywhere, anything I want, anywhere I want, that will drive that expectation of people when they're inside environments too. And so digital tools and digital elements to enhance experiences in stores, you know, think about retail, you know, retail was already moving to not being about getting things, but feeling things. How can digital help deliver better content? How can digital help enact some of these principles around the next generation of recognition and response and personalization and reward, right? How can digital help with that as well as respect? How can it help keep people safer? So I see there's a great convergence of things that were in flight pre-pandemic that now I think are become even more important. And given that pause to think about the purpose of the things we're doing, why an office, why a store, you know, why a classroom will be really, you know, kind of essential topics of debate and hopefully invention over the next 3 to 4 or 5 years.
Awesome.
That is really interesting to think about. The space is not the default, but it's part of a designed set of experiences. Wow, that's, you could go a long way with that. Like, when do we, and I suspect that that's going to substantially reduce footprints. We may have more, but smaller, because it's only for a subset of experiences that you're going to need to be face to face.
I agree.
And some will be video and some will be SMS and some will be phone. Some will be in your mind.
Yeah, it's kind of like the bonoboization of retail a little bit. Not to say that they're the best at everything, but kind of the whole concept of we're going to have a showroom where you can come in and touch the pants and see the pants and try on the pants, but you ain't leaving the store with a pair of pants, right? Kind of idea, right? So
that's long been the notion of how to save Best Buy is to compensate them. The brands compensate them on touches as opposed to box moving. Because that's what people go to do, right? They go to touch it, and they're like, okay, Amazon, bada bing, I ordered it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, good. Go ahead, Peter.
The format strategy, if you would, you know, from showrooms to experience environments to, you know, dark kitchens and the kind of the multiplicity of fulfillment methodologies that these will enable will, I think, be an explosion of experimentation in format strategy. I think that one size fits all, one box, one set of shelves is not going to cut it, right? We really are going to have to think about how, for this marketplace, for this occasion, for this customer, how can this environment deliver the feeling that will make them, connect with me and as a brand, for the long term.
So I got one shameless plug here because I think that last part is super relevant. It is the explosion, high RPM, agile experimentation that in the digital world means that more companies need to be able to build their own software to manifest experimental experiences as opposed to buying it and configuring it, because you can only configure it so many ways, which means you're going to be a lot like everybody else. You're not going to be able to innovate to the extent that differentiation isn't overdone at the expense of relevance.
I agree.
Well, we are going to cap it at that. Peter, always love riffing with you, man. Thank you so much for the time. I know you got a lot going on at work and clearly at home and everything. So give the best of the family, both the Profit family and your family. And can't wait till we chat again.
Well, Dan, Rob, thank you. It was a pleasure talking about these topics. And, I hope I made some sort of sense there. And I look forward to continuing our dialogue. It's great talking to you guys.
Fantastic. Well, thank you all for listening to Art of the Possible. Rob, do you have any parting shots?
I don't. Take it away, Dan.
All right. Well, just a reminder, you guys can follow us on Twitter at Art of the P. There's a Facebook page. There's a LinkedIn page. Leave your comments there. And we cannot wait to talk about what's possible next time.